I'm Dr. Megan Corrado, and welcome to Real Stories, a podcast that features the narratives of trauma survivors, professionals, and community leaders. Real Stories provides a platform for guests with diverse life experiences to voice and honor their unique narratives. During today's episode, we will be speaking with Dr. Janelle Junkin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be a part of this conversation.
So, can you tell us a little about who you are?
Sure. Yeah. Where to start? So I'm a board certified music therapist. Let me ask you, you want personal, professional, or combination of both?
So it's actually up to you. So whatever you feel comfortable sharing as far as your identity or different qualities that are a part of your personality and who you are, you can feel free to share personal, professional, or a combination of both.
Okay, great. I'm going to do a combination. So I'm going to backtrack and actually I'm going to introduce myself on the more personal side. So I in this day and age, I think it's important and necessary to say that I am a white cisgendered woman. And personality wise, I think I am hilarious. And I'm a nerd, and I love to read and explore and discover. I love traveling, so the having to not travel right now is a big bummer. Mm. I have a great group of friends who I just adore and love, and they're just fabulous and a good part of my life. And I'm a musician, so I'm classically trained on the flute, and I started playing when I was 12. No, I started playing when I was 9. I started performing when I was 12.
Wow, that was early.
Yeah. And then I went into music therapy because my band director in high school, I had known that I'd wanted to do something with music, and I enjoyed psychology. I'd taken a psych course, an intro to psych course in high school. But I really wanted to do music, and I thought I don't love teaching, and I do not want to be a music teacher. I'm also not a morning person at all. And so having any type of teaching schedule, like, makes me cry when my sister teaches and I'm like, no,
I don't know how they do it.
I could not do it. I could not do it. When people are like, oh, should we do an early morning meeting? And I'm like, sure. 9. So I knew I didn't want to teach, and I didn't love performing, and I was being groomed to be a performer. I was actually, to be honest, I was taking lessons from, for people in the flute world, if you have any of, but I'm doubtful there's very few of us, but, James Galway is like one of the most famous flautists. He's from Ireland, and, his student was my teacher. So I was being groomed to perform, and I didn't love that because it's just, you're isolated from people. You're just kind of practicing all the time.
Oh, wow.
And, so my band director said, you know, there's this thing called music therapy. You should check it out. And I'm fortunate because it turns out that in the city that I lived in, there were actually two music therapists who were, practicing. And so my senior project in high school was I got to shadow them for 6 months and watch what they did. And I got to make a little video about it. And I thought, yep, this is the profession for me. Mm-hmm. So I'm a music therapist. And so I play the flute, but to be honest, I don't use the flute in my therapy. I tried, but it's such a personal instrument for me that I don't enjoy using it in a therapeutic context for other people.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So I really stick to piano, guitar, and other wind instruments like the recorder and things, different percussion instruments and voice. You know, that's what I use in my music therapy life, but I don't use my flute.
Okay.
Yeah. And I discovered pretty early on that when I started practicing music therapy, that music became about my clients. So I lost a little bit of my personal connection to it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I kept the flute separate.
Okay. So you could kind of have your own artistic, expressive medium that wasn't necessarily tied to work.
Yep. For sure. Yep. And then, so I was doing that, and then, and after I had done my master's, so I have my master's in creative arts therapy. So I actually had a little bit of an introduction to art and dance movement therapy, which was fantastic. I loved understanding how all three modalities, were related and not related and how we work together. And so I had gone full time into outpatient therapy in North Philly, and really just I have a hard time with seeing systems that don't work well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so
That's a nice way to say that.
Yeah, thank you. I found it difficult to work in a high crisis area with children and adults, or no, I'm sorry, with children and families, and and to see that a lot of the diagnoses that were being given also had some environmental and cultural contexts that were, mm-hmm. I felt were being ignored. Mm-hmm. And it felt disingenuous to have people come into my office to work on some coping skills and then, you know, not, and I, of course, don't live in those neighborhoods, and so I didn't have a really good contextual understanding of what they were coming from and the experiences that they were having. And so I could obviously try and understand as much as I could through questions and through listening and through being present. But it just felt strange to me to say, well, you know, come in for this 1 hour a week, feel safe, go through all these things, but good luck back out there.
Yeah.
and so it just ended up not being for me in the end. And then I kind of felt like, oh man, I what am I doing then with myself? And so I went from that to working with early intervention childhood development. So working with kids who were on the autism spectrum, who were medically fragile. Some were end of life care, as well. And I actually really enjoyed that, to be honest, to discover how to use music, without verbal processing. So completely different from what I had been doing prior. So kids who didn't have language. And so it was all about the sounds and the nonverbal interactions and how to, learn how to read that so that I could respond appropriately and correctly for what they needed. So that I enjoyed that. I did that for about 4 or 5 years, I think.
It sounds like you've worked with a lot of different populations.
Yeah, I have. This is true. I have, actually. So my first experience actually with music therapy in my home city in Connecticut, I worked with kids who were on the autism spectrum and who had cerebral palsy or who had Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. And I also worked with medically fragile kids, actually, to be honest, who lived in a group home. So that was my first experience into music therapy. And then after I graduated with my bachelor's and had done my my internship hours and became certified, I actually worked with the elderly. Mm-hmm. And so I did in-home visits with elderly. And at the same time, I was also working for a community arts organization here in Philadelphia and working with musicians. Primarily to work in underserved communities and provide access to the arts. And then when I did my master's, I was working with children and families in kind of like crisis situations in North Philadelphia. And then, right, I did a few years with, again, the special needs kids who are medically fragile in, mm-hmm. and then I spent a couple of months, actually, I'd been invited to go to Zambia in Lusaka, which is the capital, to actually stay at a village for an orphanage for kids whose parents had died from the AIDS epidemic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I actually lived in the village with them. And I got to go into the schools and work with them. And I got to go into their homes, and they had house mothers. So people who were helping to take care of them and to help support them. So I really enjoyed that. And then back in the States, and then I switched from that into doing work with refugees and survivors of torture who were placed here in Philadelphia, and had done that for about three years. Yeah.
You have such an extensive resume. Yeah.
It's a little bit all over. It can be, yeah. But it's good. I like it. I realize for me personally, I'm a builder. I'm not a maintainer. And so I very much value going in and building structures and foundations, getting things set up, just transferring skills like skill sharing and task shifting, mm-hmm. and then stepping away, and whatever becomes of it is what becomes of it. Yeah. So that, I think that's also part of why I have done such a different variety of things. Because I enjoy that kind of moving around and exploring different ideas and populations, and figuring out how to work and what does that mean for me and for them, whoever I'm working with. Mm-hmm.
So we know that every individual, every community, every system has a story, and every story includes both adversity and strength. Can you talk to us about some of the adversities that you faced?
You know, so this is interesting. I'm swinging on a little bit of a tangent, but I promise this is all related. I've been doing some work for the last 5 years with this organization called Mind Leaps, which is a dance company that teaches cognitive and socio-emotional skills through dance. Mm-hmm. And they do it with kids who live on the street, who are one generation removed from genocide in Rwanda, kids in Guinea who are survivors of Ebola. They work in refugee camps in Uganda and Kenya and Rwanda, and then are working with groups of kids in North Macedonia. And so I've been teaching. So when the pandemic hit, they had to obviously switch what they were doing, and they created instead this virtual academy. Yeah, which is quite interesting. So you teach via WhatsApp, which is amazing, because that's what they have access to. Yeah, it's quite fantastic. So I've been doing this 5-week curriculum on child development, trauma, and some introduction to CBT skills, cognitive behavior therapy skills, with these kids in Uganda, Guinea, and Rwanda. And by kids, I think the youngest is 15 and the oldest might be 21 or 22.
Okay.
So young adults, I should say. I should stop saying kids. They're young adults. So what I was thinking of is, you know, one of the conversations that we continuously have in with the different groups is, you know, the importance of the early childhood development and kind of what happens there and how that can shape parts of who we become. And although there are opportunities for kind of relearning and reparenting in ways for healing, you know, those initial years are really important. So I was thinking, you know, for me, I had my dad was in the military. And so I spent the first 7 years of my life traveling around the country. And I was actually also born in Germany on a military base. Mm. And And so when I think I was about seven, my dad just kind of decided, I'm sure there was a lot of stuff that went on that he just didn't want to be a dad anymore, or a husband for that matter. And my mom had a high school education, and she was a housewife. And so my dad, so they ended up separating and divorcing, and my mom and my brother and my sister and I ended up moving in with my grandparents, my mom's parents, and who also, I mean, interestingly, my grandfather had, my grandparents from my mom's side are actually from like West Virginia, Kentucky coal mining region. Mm-hmm. And so my grandfather, I believe he might have had a high school education, and I can't remember if my grandmother did as well. I have this vague memory that I think she stopped education like around 13 or 14, but I could be wrong around that. Mm-hmm. So all blue collar workers, worked in factories. And then my mom, also worked was a deli slicer at the, in the local grocery store. So we were six people living in this, house together, and, just a lot of kind of chaos, in the midst of all this, I will say I was very fortunate that I had grandparents who could take us in and who were loving and took care of us, mm-hmm. And worked together. But that rejection by my dad at such a young age, and then he was very inconsistent. So, he'd say, I'm coming to visit you, and then just not show up and that type of mm-hmm. thing. So that mm-hmm. that was constant. And so for me, I internalized that very early on that like, you can't trust people. They tell you all types of things, but they don't show up. And, mm-hmm. or thinking that in some ways I'm disposable, right? That I'm not – there's not whatever something about me doesn't mean that someone's going to stick for the long term. So those were like the internal messages that I took from that. And it's taken me many years to kind of unravel that and pull that apart and say like, actually, no, those things weren't true. Mm-hmm. But that really did, go through and in some ways very much shaped like who I became and the things that I get involved in. And in some ways, like when I work with certain people or interact with them, and they might say, well, you don't understand what it's like. And I'm like, well, actually, I know what it's like for six people to have $20 for a week. And you don't mm-hmm. know. Actually, I do know what that is, mm-hmm. And I'm a welfare kid. I know what that is too. I'm using those as adversity, but also I don't necessarily mean that in a negative sense, rather than, just kind of now I see them very much as learning opportunities. But I would say probably at that time, I was like, oh man, how are we going to, having worries as a kid of like, are we going to be able to have enough food or, are our needs going to be met and that type of thing. Yeah. That's probably the one that's the most constant for me, because even as I have worked towards my own healing and things like that, that's the thing that creeps back up on me mm-hmm. every once in a while. I don't want to fabricate anything that's adversity. So I've had my share of, of setbacks, of hurdles that I've had to overcome. Actually, my biggest disappointment was my doctoral studies.
Oh, yeah.
I had actually I won't name the schools or anything like that, but I had actually applied and gotten into a program in at a university in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. That I loved. And I had done 2 years in the program and was heading towards my what do you go from student to candidate? comps, my comps. And the university went through, I'm not totally sure what happened, but they did this huge upset and they ended up firing all of our faculty, our president, all of our dissertation chairs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was wild. And then they were trying to force us to sign papers saying that we were going to take a different course of study. And it was a nightmare. And but it was a program that I was so interested in. I was loving what I was learning and the people who I was learning with and from. And I was like talking to a friend of mine and said, you know, I have a colleague who works at this other university, and why don't you call her and tell her what's going on and see what she says. And I'll be honest, I really thought she would say to me, you know, put on your big girl panties, finish this program. You have, like, I had a year and a half left.
Oh, you were almost done.
Yeah. And she didn't say that. She said, that sounds like a mess and you need to get out of that university. Mm-hmm. And I was just so devastated because it was the program I wanted. It was the location I wanted. It was the faculty I wanted. It was the people I was learning with. And so I ended up transferring, shockingly enough, to a different university, and it was a fine learning experience. I wasn't a great fit, I don't think. I had just a different value set and interest, I think the university tried to accommodate that as best that they could. But yeah, I definitely walked away with the doctorate that I was not intending to get in the first place. So. Yeah. So that was interesting. So I think where I'm going to end up, I've circled, but I think with adversity, I have a hard time focusing on that because I'm a problem solver. And so I tend to see, oh, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a challenge, or this is going to be very difficult and I don't like it. Sometimes, you know, I will have that somatic response to, or like I'll get sick from it, but I'm going to do what has to be done in order to move forward. Yeah.
So let's actually segue into our next question. So can you share a few important positive moments or turning points in your story?
Yes. So I'll start back with my dad. So two things that come to mind about that. One of them was my grandfather, who is just like the sweetest, funniest, craziest 90-year-old man. and to be honest, I call him either granddad or granddaddy. So, which is funny because I would never use that with my actual dad. And so my granddad really, he just like accepted me for who I was. Like I never felt like I had to be somebody that I wasn't around him. And I don't think it's definitely not until like the last probably 10, 12 years that I really was like, oh man, what a gift that was and continues to be for me. And then the other one that comes to mind is my mom had some best friends in the area. And who they were married and they had, five kids. And so he had his own family. But when we first moved back, he would, after he would get out of work, he would come to our house first and he would play with us. And he did that because he believed that it was important that children had a father to interact with. Right. And just like the selflessness of that act. And we're really good friends actually with their kids and stuff like that because we've grown up together. But so those are the two that come to mind. And again, I would say the truth is I don't know if I really understood or put it all together in the moments as a young person about like what that meant to me. But now as an adult, I'm like, oh man, I think those two men, my grandfather and this other man, you know, giving selflessly and accepting me and my siblings for who we are, really helped in the healing process, even though we weren't aware of it in the moment. Mm-hmm. And again, mm-hmm. shaping who we became. And some other really positive moments. You know, I would say has been I tend to be a risk taker, especially when it comes to like my professional life. Mm-hmm. And so I'll just try things and, you know, we'll just see what happens. And so I'll often just reach out to people and say like, hey, I want to do this, or I think this is something that's worthwhile. And I would say more often than not, it's rare for me to get the turn down on something like that. And so, you know, experiencing having that experience at the outpatient center really moved me more towards how do we become more involved in like social justice and in really seeking equity for people. Mm. And then in 2009, I actually was part of a team who traveled to Colombia. So there were 12 of us, 4 Canadians, 4 Americans, and 4 Colombians. And I spent 3 weeks traveling with them, and we were hearing stories and witnessing the stories of survivors of the armed conflict in Colombia, and really learning about how U.S. and Canadian policies politically directly contributed to the unrest in this country and in Colombia. Mm-hmm. And so for the first time, I did have a it's not the first time, but this was one of the second times that I had really had a solid understanding and firsthand encounter with people to hear about like the fact that the way that I live my life is made possible because other people were being oppressed for it. Mm. And yeah, and really just kind of sitting with that. And what we ended up doing is we were able to work with an advocacy group, and the 4 of us who traveled from the U.S. were actually able to go to Congress and speak with different congressmen about what we had witnessed. And, you know, I don't think any policies changed, but at least we made our voices heard and said, mm-hmm. this has to change. This can't continue. And actually, now that I'm thinking about that, the first time that I really, really, really became aware of that was I was 16, and I'm actually a Hugh O'Brien Youth Foundation scholar.
Okay.
And so when I was 15, I wrote an essay around social justice, and I submitted it, and I won for my city.
At 15?
Yeah.
Wow. So you were an activist.
Yeah.
Even in the midst of the adversity that you were experiencing at home.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Right. Because, yes.
That's amazing.
My whole thing has always been how do I had go through these things and – you know, how do I help other people either go through their own healing or maybe avoid the same type of things that I have gone through? Mm-hmm. So, right. So I won for my city, and then I went to the state. And so I was spent time I think it was an entire weekend. And so met some really great people. And then I went international that summer. And so I was part of a team of about, I think it was about 25 of us. And so the youngest was 16, which was me. And the oldest was 22 or 23, I think. And we traveled to Malaysia, Indonesia, China, and Hong Kong. And really, we actually, we went to different factories and Undertone being sweatshops. And we actually got the opportunity to tour them. We weren't allowed to speak to workers, but we definitely had the opportunity to speak to the executives. And mm. and that that was the most striking was. I'll give the and you can decide if you want to edit this out. Was actually the Nike factory in China, mm-hmm. and the conditions in the factory were just abysmal and poor ventilation, and I couldn't hardly breathe, and I was only in there for like 10 minutes maybe. Wow. And then to go and there, you know, it was fans, so it was an AC, it was not great. And and then to literally go from that tour to the executive office where it was air conditioned and beautiful, and it was all white executives. Mm. And they all said to us when we questioned what was happening, they said, well, they have a better life here than they would if they didn't work for us. Mm. And I thought, oh, okay, I got it. The United States, we're not good. We do some not good things in the name of economics and policies and things, and people are harmed because we have specific ways of life. And so that, so that was I was 16 when I had that experience, and then I found out about the music therapy thing, and so you know that just kind of moved me forward. But right, how do I, how do I participate in providing opportunities for healing for people and advocating and being a voice against oppression and harm.
Right. And then so and listening to like your professional story and some of the childhood experiences that you had, it sounds like it sounds like there's a theme of kind of the adversity always being present, and the adversity being very much there, but also like identifying ways for transformation and empowerment and advocacy, even in the midst of all the things that you experienced and the things that you witnessed others experience.
Yes, always. Yes, that is true. And wow, I'm so glad you framed it like that. That's so useful and helpful. Yes, that's true. I think adversity is, and I don't mean that this isn't a complaint or it's not meant to be a downer in any way, shape, or form. Adversity is present, right? It is ever present. And in some ways, I think it's the companion that goes with transformation. Mm. Now that we're talking about this in the way that you framed it, I'm thinking, right, I think instead of viewing adversity as a stopping point, I tend to view adversity as I have a point where maybe I need to grieve, and then I need to look for what needs to change to continue moving forward. Mm. And I would say that is both that's a personal theme that I have translated into my professional life. And even when I did my my dissertation, I ended up, it was I was looking at the role of music in conflict transformation. Mm. And I had originally been slated to actually go to Nazareth in Israel because there's an orchestra called Polyphony Youth Orchestra bringing together Israeli and Arab youth through music. Mm. And I was just so fascinated by that and what changes so they were saying, you know, there's this, it's enough to share a music stand. And I thought, oh, I'm a music therapist. And so I think that's a part of it. And I think the other part is, how do we start to talk about it? Mm. And just as I was, so about a year out from when I was supposed to leave to go over, there was rockets being lobbed into the area I was supposed to live in. So they said, we're sorry, you're a liability. We can't let you come. And so I was like, oh man, what am I going to do? And that was the time that the Black Lives Matter movement was really taking off for the first time and in a very public way, mm-hmm. In a very mainstream way here in the U.S., so around late 2015. And I live in a section of Philadelphia, which is in an area that's primarily African-American, Latino, were my neighbors. And so I'll say this, my neighbors would say, well, you live in a black and brown neighborhood. And that's very true. And I was thinking about the messages that the young men and women in my neighborhood were receiving about who they are and the value that they have in our society. Mm-hmm. And I had a great advisor at my university, and she said to me, why don't you start your own program, mm-hmm. your own music program? And so I did. So I founded Orchestral Dialogues, Accepting Self, Accepting Others, specifically to address what I called an armed racial conflict, and specifically with the intent of bringing together children of different backgrounds, socioeconomically, racially, ethnically, to have space to, so they got, we rehearsed twice a month and at that time, and they got private music lessons. And then once a month, I brought in a dialogue, transformative dialogue specialist. And we then talked about what the things that they were learning about in music. So talking about like the metaphors of rests and of harmony versus dissonance versus unison. And so it was just like this really fantastic learning experience. And so in the first year we had 13 kids, and I would say the bulk of them had never played an instrument before or read music. And man, in 5 months, these kids learned how to play their instruments. They were reading music, they were playing together, and they were learning you know, things about like identity development. And so it was just this huge thing. And what's interesting is when I first submitted, or when I first defended my initial part of my dissertation stuff, I had, like I said, I had named the U.S. conflict as an armed conflict. And my committee said, oh, no, we think you should remove that language. And I said, okay. And then I defended my dissertation the weekend, the Monday after the thing in Charlottesville that had happened. And so my committee was like, you need to put that language back in there. And so I did. But right, so I'm again, and I, so I think like right, I'm always about how do you transform adversity. And I think the other thing that I have learned, and it's been a hard lesson for me to learn, is sometimes transforming adversity means you have to stop being in relationship with some people, and that's a difficult lesson to learn. I think
it is.
Right. And so it's like I can forgive people and I can harbor no ill will towards them. I can have regrets around it. I can wish things were different, and I can know that I cannot be in relationship with certain people anymore.
Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about the program that you created to bring different people in the community together and have them create music and also engage in dialogue. And it sounds like the conflict was very present in the room, and that was maybe part of the goal, was to get people together from opposing viewpoints in the same space. But then it also sounds like the connection was also very present in the room, and the opportunities for growth and healing were there too. That's just really a unique thing to almost say, you know what, we're going to welcome conflict here in the space, in this room. We're going to allow it, and we're going to work through it together.
Yes. I mean, I am not typically a conflict avoidant person. And so I, because of that, I tend to think that some of the best ways to do it is to allow the conflict to be present. Again, I'm always thinking about not harming. Mm-hmm. It was the idea that we could be in disagreement, we could be in conflict, and we could still be together. Mm-hmm. And then the value of so the kids also, we did a lot of self-reflection, right? And so asking them to think about things, to draw things, to share. And what was really interesting that first year, especially, one of the things that was completely unexpected is I had a number of the parents actually participated in the dialogue workshops.
Oh, wow.
Which was not an intent of the program at all. You know, parents would wait for their kids. And so they'd say, well, can we join you? And I was like, oh, I don't, yeah, that's fine. I don't care. I welcome that. And mm-hmm. so I think that also allowed other areas of transformation of kids being able to hear things that their parents were expressing and parents maybe hearing things differently about what their kids were talking about, their own experiences. So the relationship was key, mm-hmm. right? And so building the trust, it had to happen on multiple levels. I had to build the trust with my staff. I had to build the trust with the kids. There had to be trust built with the parents. And we have a local partner school. And so we needed to build the trust with the school as well. The whole thing, it was relational, right? I don't think we would have had the success if there wasn't the intent behind the relationship building. Mm. Mm-hmm. And so many times it was sitting and talking. Mm-hmm. Listening in order to move things forward. Yeah.
To be able to have that trust and that safety first.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. That had to be the underlying foundation.
Mm-hmm. So what do you see for yourself moving forward?
Right now I'm dipping my toe into the academic world.
Okay.
What I actually really love, my favorite thing to do, two things. I got my doctorate because for two reasons. One, it was practical, because I do work a lot in international environments, or I'm traveling internationally, and I'm a woman, and mm-hmm. And I knew, and I was had opportunities to sit at tables and have conversation, and it dawned on me very quickly that the letters behind my name mattered. Yeah. And so it was actually more practical getting my doctorate than it was anything else.
Okay.
I knew that I needed my doctorate in order to be taken seriously in certain areas that I work in. I really discovered through my doctoral program, I love doing research, and I love the monitoring and evaluation process. Mm. And I'm very much interested in how do community organizations and how do communities gain access, equal access to research and to monitoring and evaluation, so that it's not held by elites or academics, but rather it's how do communities begin to actively engage with and lead, mm-hmm. Those things. And so that's actually where I'm very interested. I don't have a fully formed thought around that, but that has held a lot of interest for me.
Mm. And our dreams, future ambitions do not need to be fully formed either.
That's right. Yeah. And so I've done participatory action research, so I'll share this very quickly, because this is one of the things that I'm super proud of. When I was doing my initial research with Mind Leaps in Rwanda, I'd spent some time in Rwanda, and I was working with the street kids, and we were wanting to understand the impact of this dance program. And here are kids who literally live and sleep on the streets, and they would walk. Some of them would walk for hours to come to this 2-hour dance class. And, mm. and of course, while they're walking and they're dancing, they're not able to work for or forage for food, right? Mm. And so I thought, well, why are they coming here? What is the benefit of this? And so we did a research study, and. And then one of the people we were working with said, we really need to make sure that the kids who are coming are actually representative of the kids in this area who live on the street. And so we thought, well, how in the world are we going to gather that information? And because they're not going to talk to me. First of all, I'm a white woman. And second of all, I don't speak Kinyarwanda. Mm. And so I said, well, can you identify top four kids in the program, kids who have some basic literacy, who can read and write in Kinyarwanda. And so they did. And so I flew back over there and I sat with them and I said, this is the information I need to gather. And here are the questions that I've come up with. And they said, you can't ask the kids this. And I said, great, here's the information that I need to get. How are we going to get it? And they mm-hmm. actually helped me design the tool. And then we spent time practicing how to use it. And then essentially, we decided that we were going to work together. They were going to be researchers with me. And so every day I would give them the surveys that needed to be completed and money for transportation. And we always wanted to, because food was very precious on the street, I worked with a local merchant to get food to give to anybody who was willing to give us even partial answers for the surveys. We thanked them with food. Mm. And then we worked with a local restaurant, and I was able to pay for meals for all of the boys for, I think, 10 days. Mm. And so they could go in and they could eat when they were hungry. And so because they were working for me, and we wanted to make sure that they were sustained. Mm-hmm. And so they did. So these kids in 10 days, these four boys got 178 completed surveys.
Wow.
Yeah. Of just kids who are living on the streets around them. And then, you know, at the end of it, when I was talking with them and thanking them, and they just said, one of the kids said to me, I'm going to be a researcher too. And I was like, yeah, because you already are a researcher. Mm-hmm. You know, and they said, well, if you write a book, we want to write the book with you, you know? And so, and that sits with me because I just think about the importance of not doing research on people, but doing research with them and being able to say, well, this is the information that is needed. And I'm open to how we can work together to get that, you know, or how do we devise these questions together? And so I would love to figure out how to do that on a larger scale. Mm. And I think especially about Philadelphians who, you know, with all the amount of research institutions in our city, I think, you know, people are frequently researched on. They are very rarely engaged in the process. Mm-hmm. And what would it be for Philadelphia to reclaim research and for Philadelphians to say, actually, no, you're not going to do research on me, but I can collaborate with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there any favorite or life-changing resources that you want to share with listeners?
There's a book called Crazy Like Us, mm-hmm. and it's written by, I think his name is Water. Last name is Water. He's a journalist, and he went through and he went to, I think, six different countries, and he interviewed psychiatrists and psychologists who work and in their countries. And so I read this one, and it was the first time that I had the understanding from a psychological standpoint that we are colonizing the world through psychology. Hmm. And so that was a huge turning point for me because it made me stop and step back in my own field and say, oh, mm-hmm. you know, what do I need to step back from here? And how do I need to be more culturally competent in the work that I do? And with that also is, you know, the field of, or the area of liberation psychology, which comes out of Latin America, with Martin Barro, also just something, an excellent resource to read. So those would be, I think, in the psychology, those were the two that changed everything for me.
Okay.
From in music, I think it's subjective, right? It so for me, I mean, this will just fit with what I told you earlier about being a teenager, right? It was the song "Zombies" by the Cranberries.
I thought you were gonna say something like seriously academic. No. But that is all right. We have all types of different resources.
And then the other book that I'd read was called Poverty and Psychology, From Global Perspective to Local Practice. And how we pathologize poverty in this country. And many other people do as well. But I will speak from the U.S. context because that is my context. So yeah, those are all books. And then, you know, a friend of mine years ago gave me a book called Listening is an Act of Love.
That's a powerful title.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a great, and it's written by Dave Isay, Isay.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your vulnerability and for processing personal and the professional and how all of them kind of merge together.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Real Stories. The resources referenced by today's guest speaker will be included in the episode description. For more information about me, Dr. Megan Corrado, and my work with the Stories Trauma Narrative Intervention, please visit my website, www.storiesguide.com. Also, feel free to follow my Stories social media pages on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Remember that for every story of trauma and adversity, there is always a story of strength and resilience.